Hi, and welcome to the Inside Out Security Show. I'm your host, Cindy Ng, and joined by security practitioners Chris Kaiser and Killian Englert. And I want to start off the show to hear your thoughts on the catchphrase, if you can't build in security, then build in accountability. And it's based on the idea that since you can rarely build a perfect security model for any framework and infrastructure, you can certainly build in accountability and traceability. Why do you think accountability is the next best thing, or perhaps we should shift our mindset and paradigm so that it's not so economies driven and that maybe we can finally give security the justice it deserves and do it properly?
This is Chris. The way that I see it, it's between two things. It's if somebody is trying to accomplish something that you don't want them to, for instance, you know, reading data that they're not supposed to or accessing a system that they're not supposed to, if you can't stop them from physically doing it, making sure that you're aware of what they're doing and they're aware that you know they're aware of what you're doing is a pretty powerful deterrent to keep them from trying to accomplish that. So effectively, if you can't stop them, make sure that you're watching them and make sure they know they're being watched. I definitely agree with that. I think that's a great way to go about it. Honestly, I would kind of say do both. Do the best that you can to stop them, but know that there are eyes at the same time.
This is Killian. I would almost even take it a step further and say that I think it should be a good feedback loop as well, too. I think we can't just simply give up the pursuit of security and say, well, you know, this monitoring or auditing is good enough. It should be, as I mentioned, a feedback. So we can see what they're doing. We can monitor what they're doing. And that's critical. But I think we need to take steps to use that information. We can see, you know, what people are doing, who's doing what, how they're doing it, perhaps where they're coming from, and use that to increase security. Hey, it looks like it's pretty easy for people to come in this way or do this type of activity. What additional steps could we build in the process or the software in the future versions to help mitigate some of this? So it's, you know, that's maybe pie in the sky, but I think it's important.
Thanks, guys. If you're a regular listener and enjoy your show, if you can leave us a review on Apple Podcasts and tell others about the show, it helps them discover great podcasts like ours. And I wanted to tie our icebreaker question in with the controversial Bloomberg article that alleged that Supermicro duped almost 30 companies into buying backdoored hardware. It was such a bombshell article, and I wanted to continue our discussion on accountability versus security by design. Brian Krebs, he interviewed Tony Sager, who is a VP and evangelist at the Center for Internet Security and a former bug hunter at the NSA, and they spoke at length about the economics of security, where now and in the future with technology, particularly with the Internet of Things, they'll be created with the cheapest parts because you can, and the device doesn't have to have a long lifespan. And to me, this is a disaster waiting to happen, because even if we have accountability, let's say we have a perimeter of the log, and if you're lucky enough to have a product like Varonis, who's going to be accountable? It sounds like it's a self-assigned accountability. And while I really enjoyed the interview, what I thought was missing in the conversation is about policy. But I have to also say that Brian Krebs wrote in another piece that even if there was enough political will and funding, history has shown us that consumers aren't willing to pay a huge premium for security when the features they want is available on a much cheaper product. What were your reactions to their interview?
I think he's right about that in terms of what people are and aren't willing to pay for. I think that people are kind of primed to assume a certain price for, say, if it's like an Amazon Echo, it's going to be X number of dollars. If they believe that it's worth that amount of money, they'll pay for it. If someone comes in with a more secure alternative, half the people out there have no comprehension of what that means for them, why it's an actual benefit, and thus it's not going to be competitive. A lot of it is about competition. A lot of it is about, you know, trying to make a product that people will buy at a price that they'll buy it at, as opposed to making the most secure or the best designed product with security in mind. I feel like a lot of this is driven by economics itself, trying to make more money as opposed to trying to make the product that, you know, has the foresight, or the design has the foresight to protect the users of it. And I think that's a big flaw in a lot of the stuff is designed. I feel like people are just looking for something. I mean, for instance, I keep thinking about buying myself an Amazon Echo compatible power strip or something like that. And I keep seeing companies that I've heard of that probably put some sort of, you know, thought into the security and design of it, charging far more than, say, some company I've never heard of who wants you to pay half for it. And I believe part of it is going to be just in terms of design, and part in terms of security, in terms of, you know, whether or not that device is designed with the protection of the consumer and their data and their information in mind. At least that's how I'm taking it from my perspective.
Even as, you know, savvy consumers, we're never going to break that device apart and look at what's inside of there. A big issue, and it came up in the article as well too, is white labeling. You could buy the no-name brand for half the price, or you could buy the name brand, but there's a fair chance that the internals could be the exact same. You know, the name brand could just white label whatever the operating system is, maybe throw on a little bit more software on top, but it's going to be the exact same hardware in there. And I think as savvy consumers, there's a certain extent, as you mentioned, that you'll go and thinking, oh, you know, it's going to be better design, something like that. But especially when it comes to hardware security, I doubt any of us are going to get to that level, which is tough. Now, you have the sites like, you know, iFixit and stuff like that who will go and tear down the iPhone or the, you know, whatever it happens to be to show you what's in there, which is always kind of fascinating, but they're not getting down to the component level. The system on a chip and things like that for Android or for Apple are all proprietarily designed by them, but they're still outsourced to manufacturing as well too. So it's kind of hard to tell. And then some of the other stuff is just commodity, you know, the transistors and capacitors and, you know, whatever else goes in there.
What scares me about that whole thing is if you have two devices and one costs half of the other, and if they're almost exactly the same hardware. A situation like you see with Supermicro where there's a chip added to it, I almost think about this in terms of if there's a difference in cost, if it's cheaper, why is it cheaper? Is it because there's something missing, or is it because there's something added? Is there something in there? They always talk about if the product is free, and then that's not the product. It's you that's the product. You know, with free websites that take your data or free services that will, you know, harvest your email and then, you know, sell that to some other buyer. If this other device from this other manufacturer is cheaper, it could be that they're making up the difference in the hardware cost by gathering something from you that you don't anticipate them doing, which is what scares me a lot about this, because people assume that a nicely packaged device is safe and clean and trustworthy. And I'm not sure that's entirely the case anymore. I think that we're going to see more and more of that.
I mean, we're talking about hardware and supply chain right now, but maybe even some of the easier things is every so often you'll see an article about, you know, routers or switches or whatever being shipped with the default hardware being or the default operating system being infected with something or pre-compromised before it rolls out of the factory. And that's, maybe a much easier way to do it. It absolutely is than designing a hardware chip. But, you know, even when you, as I mentioned, even when you try and take that into account, it's sometimes difficult to verify that. And then the assumption is, and I'm not sure if this is everywhere, but I think the assumption here is if it's more expensive, it's better in some ways. And sometimes that's absolutely the case. There are always cases where, you know, the more expensive is the better. But again, going back to some of these commodity things, you have to think how much more is in the technology. Again, I'll use the cell phone example because I think that's really easy for people to understand. You know, you look at, they just did the Pixel 3 announcement versus like the iPhone. I think they're using the exact same Sony sensor in the back. So commodity hardware that they can get from anybody, but the real difference is going to be in, you know, in the software layer as well too. So it's hard to know. And I think, you know, businesses are in business to make a profit. So if they can add that little bit of markup on top of that, I would suspect that, you know, at least in the hardware game, it's probably getting fairly close.
So do you think as a business, you would really bet on which layer of security to protect and monitor in order to figure out, well, okay, should you protect the perimeter, or should you protect the hardware, or should you protect the data? And I mean, it's because security is so vast, you really have to specialize in something in order to figure out what you're doing is going to help and that you're also going to make a margin on that.
I mean, I think, and our listeners out here have probably heard every sales pitch in the book, but any company that shows up, you know, promising the panacea of security, that if you buy this thing, it doesn't matter if it's perimeter or endpoint or whatever else, it's going to solve all your security problems. You know, they've been told that by every single person. And the truth of the matter is it's frankly just simply not true. There are always going to be compromises, and it's almost has to be like a Swiss cheese model where you have holes in the cheese. There's always going to be vulnerabilities or ways for people to get through certain aspects. So focusing all of your time and effort on, you know, just on perimeter or just on endpoint or just on the data, you miss a lot. And I think that's something that, not that people don't want to hear, but it's the sad and scary reality. It has to be defense in depth. And I've said that how many times on this show at this point, but that's really kind of the important thing. kind of layering those together and taking the right approach for your organization. Now, you know, in terms of hardware security and things like that, that gives the attackers a leg up, but having good, you know, perimeter monitoring and defense can help detect some of the exfiltration. Having strong monitoring on the data itself can show you what's happening and who's accessing it. You know, some of that is designed to get around some of the monitoring. Like if you can steal encryption keys and things like that, again, encryption is not a panacea for everything either. So you need to have multiple layers in here to help detect it. So, you know, how much is your data worth, really? And how you're going to stack that up against the controls you put in place.
You addressed some of the potential protections, and so did Brian Krebs. He shared some ideas from an editorial board member from SANS on preventing supply chain threats. He mentioned some of them. We're also very familiar here at Varonis with least privilege and access control. What other ones did you like on his list or found missing?
I mean, I like the fact that the recommendation was to move away from the more permissive defaults in access control. For, you know, he said probably the default is read, write, execute, move more towards read, execute only, or even better, least privilege, which is a phrase that in my position, I say 5 times a day, at least. It's something that we've been advocating for a long time, moving people towards a least privilege model, ensuring that any user can only touch or accomplish what they need at any given time. More often than not, we find this is something that kind of aggregates over time. You know, if someone's been around for a while, they get more and more rights in an environment and the old rights aren't revoked. So this has been, you know, talking point of mine for years and years. So I absolutely agree with that. I think one of the points I thought was interesting is abandoning the password for all but trivial applications. I guess the point there, they're looking for something more like, you know, bringing in two-factor authentication, having other methods of authentication. They're saying abandon it entirely. I'm saying, I would probably say have both, have multi-factor if you can, but a password on its own is no longer the be-all end-all in the way that it used to be, considering it's easier than ever to break passwords.
I liked all the recommendations, but I think they're missing a big aspect. They talk about abandoning the flat network and moving traffic monitoring from encouraged to essential. I think those are really, really important steps, but I think it doesn't even quite go far enough. Even if you segregate the networks, for example, you get rid of the flat network and you start segregating them up, you're still going to have users and accounts and service accounts and whatever else accessing those data sources. I think in addition to that, and I've been party to processes where we've built a secure network to handle certain type of data, it didn't stop there. Think like PCI. You know, if you're going to build a secure processing area, you want to wall that off from the rest of your organization. So, well, partly for legal protection, so your whole network doesn't become in scope for PCI, just whatever segment of the network and systems are there. But you still also have to monitor what's happening in those networks as well, too. So you need to segregate the data also. You don't want, for example, sensitive or non-critical data moving into those networks and opening it up for general use. You want to try and refine it and control that as much as possible. So if you know you have sensitive data in this area, and you also have to monitor that and make sure that the process and activity around that is also handled in a specific way and locked down too. So segregating the data almost. Again, businesses are in business to grow and make money. They're going to have to deal with information that's proprietary sensitive or covered under various regulations, but making sure it's in the right place to fulfill their business needs without posing undue risk is kind of the core. And just the same concept as segregating the network, segregate the data, lock it down, and keep track of the access there. Same way you kind of keep track of who's coming and going from your network.
We discuss supply chain security. We're talking about trying to protect the data, but also in our quest to innovate, especially to create self-driving cars, is a reality that I feel like we're innovating in such an irresponsible way. The latest Google Uber lawsuit reveals something so fundamentally unsettling, where there were accidents and one of the engineers, he was quoted that if we want to advance technology, safety cannot be your number one concern. And it reveals some scenarios I think we might not be able to backpedal in the future if we're not able to address fundamental values, our society values, what innovators value, what business people value. And it feels like we've talked about this in the past, where you got to be number one because that's how you monopolize the industry. And in our quest for being number one, I feel like we're bypassing a lot of safety steps for us as a society as a whole. What do you think the implications are for humanity, security pros, and everyone in between?
There's this one quote that really stood out to me, and it kind of harkens back, and I relate it to a lot of things we're seeing in security as well. But the quote was from one of these engineers who said, and this is, I'm saying it, prefacing it with the fact that I absolutely disagree with this 100%, but his quote was, if it's your job to advance technology, safety cannot be your number one concern. If it is, you'll never do anything. And from my perspective, I read that and I see a lot of parallels in security. If it's your job to, say, make a lot of money, grow a business, a lot of people will put security by the wayside because they assume that it's an impediment. It's a way to, it stops things from, and because you're being cautious, you're being slow, it'll, in the same way that many people have hangups about government regulation of certain things. You know, this regulation is getting in the way of me growing and me advancing technology, advancing my business. And I think the article, we spoke a bit about how what happened was that they had improperly coded part of the code for a self-driving car. And as a result, this person wanted to prove that it was working great and it was fantastic, and actually caused somebody an injury because that car wasn't working properly at the time. So it's situations like that that put into context of this is exactly why the focus on, in their case, safety is very important. In our context, security is important. If someone's developing some new software and rushes it to get it out the door, or has to meet some deadline because there's going to be an economic impact if they don't, and they put security by the wayside, that's the kind of stuff where if there's a major hole that they haven't caught in that code, it's some sort of security hole, this could be very damaging to people who weren't responsible for designing in the first place. You know, if you have software that's out there that could potentially leak sensitive information, or you design an environment that doesn't have the proper safeguards for, say, somebody's personal identifying information, these are the sort of things that the cost is not necessarily on those who designed it, but those who trusted the person who designed it. And that scares the heck out of me. I think it's, you know, we often put our trust in these big companies to do the right thing and act ethically. And the fact of the matter is there are people out there who don't see it the same way. They see that the end goal is not the security of one's data and the absolute protection of their consumers, but the advancement of the technology, the advancement of the industry, the company, whatever it happens to be. So I think one of the things that I've always believed is that ethics are incredibly important, especially in this new frontier of technology where there's issues that can pop up or damage that can be done that none of us have ever seen before, none of us can anticipate. So while I understand the drive to grow, the drive to innovate, I think we have to be really, really careful. I think there needs to be extra care put in, especially because we don't know what some of these outcomes could potentially be.
You hear this exact same argument every single time someone's trying to advance technology. We heard it with AI, we heard it with the self-driving cars. Oh, well, you know, this is just going to stifle us. You know, we can't stop innovating because something might go wrong. You got to break a couple eggs to make an omelet, something like that. So I guess my question is, are these organizations capable of self-monitoring themselves? And I think from this, and it keeps happening over and over again, is the answer is maybe no. You know, let's think of another highly regulated industry, the pharmaceutical industry. They have the FDA that certifies all these processes. There's processes on how to do trials and bring things to market. And this has been well established over time. And I'm sure when they were implementing some of those processes, there was a lot of complaints about stifling innovation and things like that. You know, and maybe it slows it down a little bit. But if everybody kind of has to get on board with the same process on how to innovate, but do it ethically, I think that might negate the kind of rush to beat everybody out the door in any way they can. Would you agree with that sentiment? Disagree? Modify it at all?
I don't know. I mean, I'm pretty firmly in the camp of you have to know what the risks are going to be before you take them. I understand that, you know, the whole breaking eggs to make an omelet, there's got to be a limit to that, though. I mean, in this case, you saw a very stark reality of this cost somebody their well-being. The guy had to have multiple surgeries because this car was not properly designed, or somebody, you know, basically put him in a situation where he had to use this untested, untried technology. I think I may be more on the pessimistic side of this, as I often am on this show. I'm more on the side of caution. And I understand why one might want to push past that in many ways. I don't think I can get on board with it.
In terms of the regulation, I mean, the goal, I think, for everybody here is to innovate as quickly as possible to beat everybody else out to whatever the punch is, whatever the next thing is. Would it be an effective way to level the playing field if there was like multi-step regulations, just like the, you know, the FDA? You need to go through certain trials first, prove it out, need to be reviewed by some entity, then go to a next phase in testing. It'll slow down the process, but it'll give us checks throughout there. Do you think that could be an effective way to combat this type of, I don't want to say uncontrolled or Wild West situation here, but it would still allow people to investigate and move into new areas?
Yeah, I think I would. I think Wild West is an appropriate word for it, actually. I mean, one of the things that I fear is that if you have people who agree to these regulations, they may find ways to skirt them at the same time. They may say, you know, hey, we're banding together to make these new standards and we're making sure we're all going to hold to it. But then if they have some of their work done in another country where that regulation doesn't hold, you know, it's kind of hard to keep them accountable there. I understand the race to be first in an industry. I get why that's important. And I get why some people might find regulation or rules around it to be a holdup. But you have to consider the cost. You have to figure out what the human cost is going to be. It's different. Like if you're building out something that doesn't have the ability to harm people or to cause, you know, major damage, like someone's identity being stolen or their, you know, sort of security number or banking information be stolen, then I think the standards are going to be a little bit different. I think it has to be kind of related to the severity of what could go wrong, in a sense. You need to know what you're playing with before you jump in there. You need to know exactly what the cost could be and adjust accordingly. That's really what I think.
Okay, I had two thoughts, actually. First is, I love the FDA idea. It also reminded me of whatever happened to government R&D, where they try to search for a discovery or a solution for one thing, but found something else out as sort of like a byproduct of all their research. So I haven't heard of any technology that I can think of off the top of my head right now that has been really useful for society. And then number two is, I don't think real innovators can do think like a normal person in terms of creating something new. The first person that comes to mind and first person that comes to a lot of people's mind is Elon Musk. He certainly is a polarizing figure, to say the least. And I think he's certainly aware of limitations and having to appease everyone and doing it in a responsible way. It's tough, but I certainly don't condone safety at a cost, though, because that's just irresponsible.
How do you think the kind of obsessive cult of personality we have developed over the last couple of years plays into all of this, where the bigger the personality you are, the more bold the ideas, the higher on the pedestal you're put, with regardless of anything else, really? And again, Elon Musk is a good example of this, and Steve Jobs to a certain extent. It's a little bit different industry, but we've built up that these tech giants or these, you know, people are the new supermen, I guess, in our society, and we have flocks of people that come to them and will defend them at any cost. How do you think that's played into the kind of cavalier attitude towards safety when dealing with innovation?
Capitalism.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you talk about Elon Musk and safety. And there was one story I heard about him where they literally wouldn't paint. There's like a, I guess, a standard in how you paint factories to indicate areas where you need to be careful effectively, and they use the color yellow. And I remember hearing a story, and correct me if this is, you know, just a rumor, I could be completely wrong, but I heard that he forbade the use of the color yellow in his factories for some personal reason, and as a result, people weren't entirely clear where they needed to be careful and where they, what was a dangerous area of the factory. If it wasn't that kind of cult of personality or that blind acceptance of someone's power and control over them, that's another scenario in which if somebody comes in and it's their first day, they're expecting signage or they're expecting something in place to keep them safe, and it's not there, that could have an actual tangible effect on their well-being or their safety.
I only saw the very first episode of Silicon Valley, but I mean, that first episode where it's become parodies and sitcoms, and I just find it kind of hilarious, actually, because going back to the FDA analogy, pharmaceuticals, I don't see a Steve Jobs pharmaceutical guy out there. If you want to be responsible, it's rather important to incorporate safety. But let's also talk about, I mean, we've talked about third parties collecting our data and giving away our data, students that get their coffee at a coffee shop near Brown University. So they're offered free coffee if the students give away their names and phone numbers and email addresses, majors, date of birth, professional interests. They enter all of that in an online form. And then whoever sponsors their coffee gets to send them promotional advertisement. To me, it's very similar to when you're at a tech trade show, you give away all your personal information about your professional job and title, and then you get a free giveaway, and then here, scan my badge. And then the argument is for the students is, well, they have all your information anyways. And the controversy is, okay, well, that information can be sold to third parties. So all of this is nothing new. What I want to talk about is it's already sort of become normalized and accepted in this new way of being that I thought was so not alarming, but it's a new way of carrying ourselves as a human.
What I at least found interesting was it's kind of the distillation. It was very transparent and clear that you're trading literally your personal information for this cup of coffee. So in some ways, I guess that's respectable almost in a perverse way that like they're at least being incredibly honest that like you're literally selling your personal information for a cup of coffee. And I think, Chris, I think you're a little bit younger, but at least Cindy and I can remember a time when the internet wasn't pervasive. And I think looking at college students nowadays, my guess is they haven't grown up in a time when a computer wasn't readily available, when these free services weren't readily available. So they've been born directly into a society where your personal data is in many ways not personal anymore. It's kind of traded freely out there. And I don't think that we're going to be able to put the cat back in the bag.
Yeah, I mean, some of the argument was made by one of the people who was interviewed for this that, yeah, this information's out there anyway, so I might as well get some free coffee out of it. And I'm like, well, so I also, first off, I think it's very nice of you to say that I come off as younger. Very kind of you to say. I do remember the early days with you know, dial-up and everything like that. So yeah, I remember before this stuff was pervasive, and maybe that gives a different perspective on it. This reminds me of two things in particular. I actually participated in a art project years and years ago, like 2014 or so, in Brooklyn, where they it's something called Please Enable Cookies, and there was an artist who conducted this experiment, and they would give you literal free cookies with like Twitter or Facebook or Instagram icons on them for giving up your personal information. And it was kind of startling. This actually took a little bit further, I think, than this coffee chain's doing. Some people were willing to actually give social security numbers, photographs of themselves, put down your fingerprints in order to trade for literal cookies. It was sort of a, you know, internet-y joke about cookies, but people are willing to give up a lot of information for very simple things today, and that is a little shocking to me. The other thing it reminds me of is I remember being in college, you know, forever ago, and I remember a couple of friends of mine came back from something, they went to some event, and they had full pizzas in their arms and free t-shirts. And I was like, well, how did you get those? You go, oh yeah, we signed up for a credit card. And I was like, what? You did what for this? Like you gave them all of your information, and you'll give yourself a financial, a burden in a sense, or a responsibility in exchange for a t-shirt and some pizza. And it blew my mind that people would do that. But clearly this is becoming more and more normal. So there's one piece of this article I wanted to talk about. I wasn't sure exactly what to make of it. One of the quotes was, I guess this Shiru Cafe exists in Japan as well. And they said that 40% of the new hires in JP Morgan in Japan were patrons of that cafe. And that's so weird to me because it sounds like they're using it not only for marketing research, but for recruitment as well. And I can't tell if I love it because it gives people an easier route to finding a job, or I hate it because it's really invasive.
In some ways, as I said before, it's almost ingenious in the fact that it is so forthright with what it's trying to do. You know, what's the harm here? You can show some benefit that these companies are using it for recruitment. It's a way to short circuit kind of some of the pain in the behind hunting for talented job candidates is. If you think about the traditional way, and Chris, I know you've hired people before. You know, it can be overwhelming to sort through resumes and try and find the right person. And, you know, there are tons of solutions out there that attempt to do this. You know, all of the different, you know, myriad of job sites all, you know, advertise a way to do this. And I think that this is just another way to do it as well, too. They're getting the information about the students before they graduate. It gives businesses almost maybe a leg up in terms of being able to pre-sort who they might be interested in terms of, you know, their major and, you know, interest and things like that. So I guess that is one benefit, you know, but again, for me, it's not something that I would, it's something I'm incredibly wary of.
For me, I agree with you. It helps recruitment. It serves a certain particular purpose. But for me, it's really about it's great until it's not. because I think of the recent privacy notification I got from my health insurance that they might request financial information about my own records in order to provide proper service for my healthcare. And I didn't have a chance to look into it so thoroughly yet. I appreciate the heads up. But then I came across another article about how our financial information can easily be for sale and how there are actual people that use pretexting to get their hands on our financial information. And I just find that to be so alarming. So I think depending on your own level of comfort, perhaps, that's where you might draw the line, that even though people, there's a critique of it's on the onus of an individual to give out their data, I actually don't mind it. If I have a list of all the different vendors and services that have my info, I would be happy to say yes, no, maybe so for whatever vendors that want my information. But to not know and to work with, say, a business that maybe they engaged with me before, but I just didn't know, and that they secretly found out all this information about me, I just think that's shady.
Some of the listeners might not know pretexting. You may know it as another name, social engineering, effectively. The article talks a bit about these people who they kind of present themselves as information brokers, and you can say, you know, I'm trying to find out financial info about X person, and they'll call up a bank, they'll call up any other place where you might hold an account and impersonate you to find out that personal information by using social engineering techniques. I can't believe this is a job people have. I can't believe, I mean, probably not like a legitimate job, but, you know, clearly this is snooping around. This is pretending to be you, impersonating you so someone else can get your financial information. And it speaks to kind of a lack of process in place of protecting this information when someone makes a request. There should be stronger safeguards in place. If someone says, I am Chris Kaiser, I need to know, oh, I forgot my password, or I forgot what, you know, my account number is, or anything like that. It should be a lot harder to verify that and have someone figure out what it is. I know they introduced the GLBA in 99, basically to make it illegal to obtain this kind of information under false pretenses. Doesn't necessarily mean that people aren't doing it, but it's scary stuff. People need, this is something that isn't being prosecuted as much as it should be, it sounds like. It absolutely should be. That's terrifying stuff.
I mean, I think the crux of it is that even though it is illegal, it's enforced so rarely that, you know, and even on the rare occasion that a case is brought against it, the judgments on it are almost so trivial that it doesn't matter. They're probably making money hand over fist, even if they get the slap on the wrist or whatever. And then the article mentioned a couple of companies that did actually get taken to court and got fined, and then the judgment was vacated or something like that, or they only paid some small portion of the judge. It's like, meh, that's fine. It doesn't set a good example for that, too. And I think, you know, without deviating too much, you look at GDPR, you look at this new personal data privacy law coming out of California and some other places. The idea is that consumers, the people, the individuals have the right. This is their data. They own it and they can request it from companies. And, you know, maybe we'll see a change in that paradigm where someday maybe we'll get something similar. Stop some of this information brokering in its tracks. And I mean, the other part of it too is it's like anything else. If there's is there a market for it, if there's consumers for it, someone's going to set up a business around it. And that's kind of what the article alluded to as well, is that the clients of these services tend to be lawyers or private investigators and things like that. And they almost never see the light of day, or the lawyers have to know it's illegal. But if they don't ask where the data came from, they can be like, oh, I didn't know. But in many ways, I think there also needs to be prosecution against the people trying to get this information as well through one of these brokers. You know, I don't know if there's a good solution to this in general, but, you know, there needs to be something put on the books and actual enforcement.
Guys, I can't believe the year is almost over. Looking ahead to next year, what do you think we'll hear more of in 2019?
Anybody who probably listens to this show or at least knows me personally is not going to be shocked at I don't see anything getting better. In fact, I only see things getting worse. I think we're going to see more big breaches. And again, that's not wearing my little hat and holding up and the letter, like, what's the name, the Johnny Carson guy. But so far, even with, you know, GDPR coming into play and people starting to take some of this stuff more seriously, I think that there's so much data out there. It's so valuable that it's definitely worth the risk for people to keep trying to really target these big attackers. And I only see the innovation getting higher. It's like an arms race. Every time we put one defense in place, you know, the new thing that's going to stop all this, the attackers find a new way in. They get more sophisticated. And I know we haven't heard about ransomware in a little while, but I don't see that going away either. Between that and the, I think Bitcoin has kind of tumbled a little bit, so we'll see probably less of the crypto mining malware, but I still see that being a fairly steady income source for a lot of people.
Sure. I wanted to say the one ray of hope that I have is that as the years go on, I find more and more people who are outside the realm of security understand it more and more and understand the ramifications of it more and more. So I always make a point about education on this show about how important that truly is. We're starting to have people who are entering the workforce who are, as you know, Killian alluded to before, they've grown up with computers. This is normal to them. They understand how quickly data moves and how important it is to be secure about it and have best practices around it. I think we're moving in a positive direction in terms of people being smarter about how they treat their data and how they treat the data of others. That's what I'm at least hoping that we're actually going to be seeing. But people who 5-10 years ago, you know, were entering their first job or entering into this world and being more and more involved with this data, I think there's less of a concern there. I think now everyone sees the news. They see how damaging breaches can be, how damaging lack of control over your information can be. I think people are becoming more cognizant. I think that if we enter an era where everyone's aware of the stuff that people in security are, or at least more aware, I think that's a net positive.
I think to that point too is maybe on a hopeful note, I brought everybody down, so let's come up just a little bit. I think the consumerization of some security technology is becoming more prevalent. I keep getting notifications, hey, it's October's Cybersecurity Awareness Month or something like that. Like, here's, make sure you enable two-factor authentication. And they'll, you know, these organizations have produced little videos on how to do it. I've seen it from financials and things like that. And even some big players, and we talked about this a couple weeks ago, the Google Titan security keys, they're starting to roll out now and is becoming more accepted. It's a product that they're starting to sell to the people. I actually have one on the way and it should come in the next couple weeks to test out. See how it is. So the more this becomes readily available and accepted and built in to these different solutions, the more it'll be accepted, the easier we make it for people, you know, and we can move incrementally. So I see that increasing at least.
It's understandable that we only see things getting worse, but I also hear that people who have been in security for years and years say that you actually have to be a pretty optimistic individual in order to stay in security for as long as we have. So thank you to Killian Engler, Chris Kaiser, and all our listeners for joining us today. If you enjoyed our panel discussion, please subscribe to our show. You can find more episodes of the Inside Out Security Show on Apple Podcasts, Overcast, SoundCloud, and more. If you have a minute, please leave us a review on Apple Podcasts and tell other people about the show. It helps them discover great discussions like we had today. Thanks.
Thanks, everyone. Thank you.